My guest at this time is John Lott. He's an economist and the author of a number of books, including More Guns, Less Crime. He joins me now to talk about the coverage of the tragedy down in Florida, the whole Trayvon Martin, George Zimmerman controversy, and we're not going to get into the details of that specific incident, but more how the media has covered the story, what facts they have allowed to be expressed as facts, and what the truth really is when it comes to so-called stand-your-ground laws, which, of course, the state of Florida has. And John, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, let's start with what the law actually is, because as you point out in a recent opinion piece for FoxNews.com, there's been a lot of misconceptions about what a person can do under the Stand Your Ground laws, and you make the case that actually their options are much more limited than the media would have us believe. So what can and can a person do under this new, relatively new law?
A lot of states have these laws. I mean, you have 41 states that have some version of these types of laws. It's true, most of them have adopted them in the last 12 years or so, but so there are other laws that are older, but we've had a lot of experience with these laws. The basic point, though, is what they call reasonable person test. That someone has to, a reasonable person would feel that their life was being threatened, or they were facing a serious risk of bodily injury, and only at that point can they go and use force that's comparable to the risk that they suffer. So, for example, a person can't go and shoot a criminal who's running away in the back. You can't go and provoke the attacker into attacking you. And you can't use unnecessary force to stop someone. And so many in the media have been describing this as a shoot first, ask questions later type law. And, you know, if you do something like that, you're going to end up in jail. You have to really be facing serious injury or death, and it has to be something that others would agree. So you have places, I mean, it's almost countless how many places the media have misdescribed this, but you know, the Washington Post has one discussion where they say the law immunizes an individual from criminal charges if he asserts that he had a reasonable fear of grave harm. And that's not accurate at all. You have to be able to show to a judge or jurors that that a reasonable person would have had fear of that type of grave harm occurring. It's just not up to the person who's going to be using the gun to say that he felt that it was reasonable to him. And so it puts a lot more constraints on what individuals can do.
John, let me follow up on a couple of things you just said there, and you also included in your opinion piece for FoxNews.com about what the law is and what it isn't. You say you can't provoke the attacker into attacking, you can't use unnecessary force to stop the attack. Who defines exactly what would provoke an attacker or what's considered unnecessary force?
It gets into this reasonable person standard. A lot of the law, in many different cases, not just here, uses what are called reasonable person standards, and that can vary by jurisdiction and by state, but, obviously they're kind of clear divisions that are there. If you go and hit somebody first and then they hit you back, then that would be pretty clear that you had provoked the attack there in that case. If you had started screaming at somebody in their face, it may be a little bit harder to draw the line there, but it seems a lot of people would say that you had some responsibility in getting them to hit you back. So now if you were merely just walking along and somebody comes and hits you from behind, or if you're just talking to somebody and then they take a swing at you, those are quite different circumstances. And I think in those last couple cases, the court would say you had not provoked the attack in those cases.
John, you mentioned 41 states have these laws on the books. What's been the general track record so far? You mentioned that a lot of these states have done it relatively recently, but have these generally been a way to help society and keep violence down, or have they had the effect that a lot of folks are saying now is the result of these laws in the Trayvon Martin case?
Well, the third edition of More Guns, Less Crime that came out in 2010 is the only peer-reviewed academic research that exists on these types of laws, and it finds that, in fact, the states that adopt these laws had bigger drops in violent crime and murder than the states that didn't adopt these laws. You know, these laws just didn't come out of thin air. There was a reason why they were adopted, and that was prior to these laws, you had to retreat as far as possible and then warn the attacker that you were going to use your gun before you could actually fire it. And in there are many problems with it. One is when you're retreating as far as possible, you give the criminal who's attacking you more of a chance to actually harm you. And in addition, it turned out in many cases this kind of murky line about, well, who's going to decide how far you had retreated, whether it was as far as possible or not. And there are a number of cases that I go through in More Guns, Less Crime, but I give examples where, you know, in one case there was a 67-year-old man who had parked his car in a parking lot at a grocery store. A robber had come up to him, had started chasing the 67-year-old man around his car, had caught up, punched him, knocked him down once. The 67-year-old got up, tried to run away again. The robber punched him again, knocked him down a second time. The 67-year-old got up, tried to run away again, and the robber punched him and knocked him down a third time. And that third time, the 67-year-old pulled out his permanent concealed handgun and fatally shot the robber in the chest. Now, the prosecutor in that case in Oklahoma said that he thought that the 67-year-old still could have done more in order to try to retreat before he used deadly force. And he took him to court, and the 67-year-old was convicted and sentenced to 1 year probation. He didn't have to serve any jail time. But there are a number of cases like that. Florida had had cases before they had adopted their Stand Your Ground law, and you have other states. And so, you know, you have people worrying about how far do I have to retreat so I don't end up spending time in jail or end up getting convicted before I go and use my gun defensively. And state legislatures didn't want people worrying about that too much. They replaced it with this reasonable person test. So you have to, you know, when you're using this, if you're going to use force, you have to have in your mind, could you convince others that you really faced a real threat before you acted defensively or not? And if you can, then it can be appropriate for people to respond without having to run away multiple times.
And certainly an aspect that has not gotten a lot of attention is the very basics of the law in question here and what its impact has been around the country. John, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks very much.
John Lott is an economist. He's the author of More Guns, Less Crime, now in its third edition. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America, reporting for WorldNet Daily.